Well, we've been going through the Gospel of Matthew for many months now, and chapter by chapter. And this week we've got to Matthew chapter 26, and you've had it read to you. Quite a lengthy passage. I think I'd like to talk about it under the heading, Jesus Provides, We Contribute. Some people like those red letter Bibles. Bibles where the words of Jesus are picked out in red. And if you were using one of those Bibles today, you'd find that a lot of the passage that we are looking at this morning, would be in red, because they're all the words of Jesus. And I've broken up what I want to say into four topics, really, four areas that he seems to cover, or people that he addresses. I want to talk about what he says about the Passover, the communion, the disciples, and the kingdom. So first of all, the Passover. Verse 18, he replied, Jesus said, go into the city to a certain man and tell him, the teacher says, my appointed time is near. I am going to celebrate the Passover with my disciples in your house. The Passover. He wanted to celebrate that Passover. He'd made a point of getting together with the disciples for that Passover festival. Now, what was it all about, the Passover? I expect you know, but I'll remind you anyway. The people of Israel had ended up in Egypt after a long famine. They were invited in partly by Pharaoh and partly by their brother Joseph. And so Jacob and all his sons end up in Egypt. And they do very well there at first. They thrive, but 400 years later, they're in such large numbers that the Egyptians feel threatened by these immigrants and want to get rid of them, and they start to persecute them. And so the Israelites are promised the chance to escape from Israel, and they ask from Egypt, and they ask Pharaoh to release them to go into the desert to worship. And as you know, Pharaoh refuses. There's a whole series of plagues, and it eventually builds up to a final plague, the Passover, where there's the threat that the firstborn children of everyone will die unless the Israelites are allowed to go free. And there were various things about that Passover festival that happened, and that the Jews continued to commemorate. Part of it was that they would prepare the week before Passover, the actual celebration of Passover, by getting rid of yeast from their houses. And this meant that the bread that they used wasn't raised, it was flat bread. And the idea was that the flat bread was easier to transport around, quicker to move around. So there was the flat bread. Then they would kill a lamb and smear the blood of the lamb on the lintels of their houses in Egypt. And that evening, they were to eat barbecued lamb together, fully dressed in their tunics, with their sticks in their hand, ready to go. Ready to be released. And indeed, the dreadful deed happens that night. The Egyptians suffer the loss of their firstborn children, but the Israelites are spared. And Pharaoh suddenly decides, yes, you must go. I want rid of you. Go, and go now. They are free to go. And they're free from Egypt to go off. But is that the main object? Was it just freedom? What were they going for? Were they really heading off to get the Ten Commandments, to meet God at Horeb and receive, under those majestic circumstances, those Ten Commandments? Well, that was part of it, but I think one of the most significant things that happened to them after they were released was that they were told, and this happens in Exodus, they were told how to make the tabernacle, how to construct it, how to sew it together. And they followed those instructions which they were given very carefully. They followed them very carefully, built the tabernacle, and then God came down and occupied that tabernacle. He came to live with them. He came to live with his people in the desert, and he stayed with them. And that was the main object of the people's escape from Israel at that time. And this was the commemoration that Jesus chose to die at. There were other Jewish festivals. There was the Festival of Lights, Festival of Harvest, Festival of Atonement. But the one Jesus chose to make his departure at was the Passover. In the general atmosphere of opposition and plotting against Jesus that builds up in the Gospels, it's easy to picture him as reacting to events, twisting and turning in response to things that happen. But in fact, Jesus seems to be heading deliberately to a foregone conclusion. It's striking how in the first three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, he clearly sets his sights on Jerusalem, saying things like, it's not fitting for a prophet to die anywhere else but in Jerusalem. And of course, the triumphal entry was a clear claim to be Messiah, with all the risks that that might entail, but it was done in Jerusalem. Just before our passage in Matthew's Gospel, we find the authorities plotting against Jesus, but wanting to avoid the Passover. Chapter 26, verse 5. They say to each other, but not during the festival, or there may be a riot among the people. But Jesus definitely plans to have a Passover celebration with his disciples. And when Judas goes over to the other side, the authorities see their chance to deal with the problem, and they decide to do it now, even though it's Passover. It was a Passover meal that he was wanting to celebrate. And what was significant about that Passover meal, apart from the fact that the people of Israel got no release in it? Another thing about the Passover meal was that it followed a set procedure. There would be a master of ceremonies, someone there to answer questions, but one of the children was primed to ask questions about the Passover and what it meant. And this happens among the Jews, I believe, to this day, that they go through a particular ritual of Passover. And the boy in the family is supposed to ask the father what it's all about, and he replies. And Jesus would be expected to be the head of the household in this Passover festival, taking the ceremony, answering the usual questions, but he transforms the whole thing. He centres it on himself and what was about to happen to him and what it might mean. The original Passover worked out as freedom for the people of Israel. But this Passover was going to work out as freedom and release for Jesus' followers as they followed him. So, let's think now about the words that Jesus used about the communion, as he set up the service of communion as a Christian Passover festival. So turning to the communion, the bread and the wine and the words that he said then. Notice how these words are quite carefully set down. And in fact, you find almost the same words down in Matthew, Mark and Luke. They're regarded as very important. And they carefully write down the same words, more or less. And in fact, it comes up again in Paul's first letter to the Corinthians. He goes over the same ceremony again. It's obviously quite important what is actually said. John's Gospel doesn't cover it, except in chapter 6, there's a prolonged discussion about the meaning of bread and how Jesus can be represented in bread. So the Lord's Supper was not a bright idea by the church to keep reminding us of Jesus, but something he carefully set up for us. There's a set procedure for the Passover, still used by the Jews to this day. But here in this Passover celebration, the disciples saw Jesus reinventing the supper, reinventing it before their very eyes. And the focus of the meal becomes not the meal, certainly not a lamb, which isn't mentioned, but himself. And what did he say about it himself when instituting it? Well, if we look at verse 26, Jesus took the bread, and when he'd given thanks, he broke it, gave it to his disciples, saying, "Take and eat, this is my body." First of all, he gives thanks, even though he's one with the Father, the Son of the Father, the inheritor of all that the Father has, and through whom everything in the world is created. Yet he identifies with us and gives thanks to the Father for what's given. So the first thing he does is he gives thanks. He then broke it. Presumably that was to be symbolic of what was to happen to him. He broke it. And he distributed it to the disciples, to all of them. A piece for everybody. From the same loaf, everybody got a little bit. And he was saying at that time, "Take and eat, this is my body." And what did he mean? I've always felt that it must be that the disciples sitting there watching Jesus doing this ceremony must have known that he was in front of them and that the bread and wine were bread and wine. And I think it's not appropriate that we believe that there's some miraculous transformation in the actual substance of the bread and wine. But on the other hand, saying over it, "This is my body," does seem to imply a bit more than just symbolism. And so I think it's appropriate as that the Anglican belief, which is, gets it about right in my opinion, that it becomes spiritually his body and blood to us. Not materially necessarily, but spiritually his body and blood to us. And of course, as we eat together and share in that bread and wine, we become identified with him, identified with the bread and wine that's distributed to us. And also, we, of course, in a way, shelter with that bread and wine. We take the benefits to ourselves, just as the Israelites were able to shelter under the lintels with the daubed blood on that lintels. So we shelter with Christ, who is our sacrificial lamb. We shelter under the words, under the significance of, "This is my body and this is my blood." And then again the cup. Again he gives thanks. And it's one cup that they all share from. And he said, "This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins." Sin. The tendency to go wrong. Make mistakes. The sort of thing that dogs us all. That is surely a bigger force of slavery than even Egypt was. That is somehow going to be passed over through what Jesus is going to do. That's the sort of freedom which is proclaimed in this Christian Passover, a freedom from the penalty of sin. So those are the words that he gave over communion. He spoke about the Passover. He spoke about the bread and wine and its significance. And then he spoke to his disciples. And they're regarded most of the time by a pretty unreliable group of people. It's amazing, we think sometimes, that he had much to do with them. He seemed so incompetent. I don't know whether any of you saw the play performed by a famous actor called Alec McCowan, called The Gospel of Mark, or Mark's Gospel. He learnt up the Gospel of Mark from beginning to end, just like an actor can do, but he learnt it word perfect from the authorised version, and took it around many theatres in Britain in the 80s and 90s, just speaking the words of Mark's Gospel and making it dramatic. And it was very, very dramatic in many ways. But one of the recurring light spots was the recurrent mention of the disciples, who always, in his expression of the Gospel of Mark, came out as blundering fools, basically, and it was quite amusing, a recurrent laugh in the Gospel. Well, and if we look at what Jesus says to them in the upper room, they don't come across terribly well, do they? They don't even start off very sure of themselves. When Jesus says one of them is going to betray him, they all turn to each other and to him and say, is it me? Is it I? They're not even confident in their own status. We know that there'd been doubts among the disciples at one point. They said to each other, shall we stay with this chap? And Peter says, virtually, well, where else can we go? We think there's nowhere else equally significant. We'll have to stick with him. We've committed ourselves now. Not exactly ringing confirmation. So they all had their doubts, and here they are confronted with the fact that one of them's going to betray him, and they just say, is it me? Could it be me? At least they're being humble at that stage. One of them, of course, Judas, one of his own disciples, goes on as far as to betray him. And then Jesus says some other words to them. He warns them that they're all going to fall away. And at that point, they put the humility behind them, and they're now full of bravado. Of course, no, we're not going to give way, or we're not going to fall apart from you. And Peter in particular, as you know, puts himself forward as the reliable one. I will never pass away from you. And Jesus looks him in the eye and says, well, before the cock crows, you'll be denying me three times. I've talked about identification earlier on in this sermon, how we're identified with Jesus in taking the bread and wine. But perhaps to some extent it's quite reassuring to think that we are identified as disciples. We can't be much worse than the disciples anyway, even if we are trying to be disciples. And the fact is, although they had so many shortcomings, Jesus did want to share this meal with them. Even that group of very shortcoming people. A motley crew, as we might say. No great gathering, no erudite scholars, no great warriors, all unknown to the world at that stage. But all were invited and all participated. Most of them remained unknown as well. We hear about Peter and about John. James is soon executed. Philip is mentioned in Acts. And the rest of them vanish into history. So he spoke words to his disciples. And finally, his words about the kingdom. And this surely includes us. 2,000 years later, are we really part of that event? We've seen that he made it a Passover festival, that he said special words of communion to institute the communion. He spoke to his disciples. Well, you may think that all I said about the theology of the Lord's Supper is too high flown. Surely, all this theology just gives rise to theological quarrels and bitterness among us. Isn't it just really a simple memorial bringing us together? Well then, yes, I think it works at that level. It is a memorial, but that just makes it a simple mere commemoration. Reminds me of our Day of Remembrance that happens in November every year. We have symbols, we recite poems, we remember the dead, but basically nothing is going to bring them back again. But our communion is something different, really. Jesus expected to be with them later on. Look at verse 32. After I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee. I will go ahead of you into Galilee. If indeed Jesus rose again, Jesus is your host at the simple fellowship meal that he invites you to. And so perhaps as you go on participating, perhaps the meaning of that meal will become deeper to you and its significance greater. But I want to remind you toward the end of this sermon with the phrase I began. Jesus provides and we contribute. Jesus provides. We contribute. We always portray the disciples as almost bumbling idiots. But actually they were not completely ineffectual. Even in verses 18 and 19, Jesus told them to go into the city, certain man, and tell him, teacher says my appointed time is near. So the disciples did as Jesus had directed them and prepared the Passover. They did prepare the upper room. Jesus gave them the task, and they sorted it out. They sorted out the details, the bread, wine, furniture, room. Perhaps they fixed up servants. Perhaps they made sure it was private. They set things up, and Jesus came and did the work. Perhaps that's still how it works. What's expected of us. The heavy lifting is done by Jesus. But we have our place. We have our task to do. I think it's significant that Jesus uses bread and wine. They symbolize our contribution. We take it just as natural that he used bread and wine. But were they the obvious things to use? He could have used meat and water. Or apples and milk. Aren't they more natural things? But that's, I think, the whole point. He used bread and wine. We had to contribute to make bread and wine. Of course, their origin, the wheat and the vine, is with God. We didn't create them. But we have to work on them to produce bread and wine. And the same is true of the other ways in which we work with Jesus. We have to contribute our part. He contributes his. And the ultimate end, where is it all going? Not just to the forgiveness of sins, liberation from sin, but sharing together in Jesus' achievements. The Israelites wanted to worship their God in the desert, and he eventually lived with them after they made him a tabernacle to his specifications. In verse 29, I tell you, I will not drink from this fruit of the vine from now until that day when I drink it anew with you in my Father's kingdom. The ultimate aim is his kingdom. And that's what Christ is looking forward to, where he would drink wine at a kingdom festival. As it says in the verse, it's going to be with you. He wants to have that with us. This is how he's going to come to us as Christians, in the kingdom. Just as in the Old Testament, he wanted to tabernacle with us. He wants to be among us still as our God through what Jesus has done. They're exciting words. He invites us to join with him in heading toward and bringing about that kingdom with the Father. Starting now, as Jesus began to do and to teach, but going on to its ultimate fulfillment with the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and prefigured in what we do whenever we celebrate the meal set up by Jesus. That's the challenge for us. He will provide, but we can contribute. And now we'll go on with the rest of our morning service, which does not involve communion. But there is a communion on this Wednesday. Thanks.